Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first live telephone town hall with Congressman Sam Farr. My name is Jeff Crockwell, and I will be your moderator tonight. This new technology allows Congressman Farr to speak with hundreds of Central Coast neighbors while he's still here in D.C. In a few moments, we'll be joined by Congressman Farr, but first I'd like to explain the format for the next hour together. Anytime during the call, if you would like to ask Congressman Farr a question, please just press star 3 on your telephone. You will remain in the conference call until one of our town hall assistants joins you. Please be ready to give them the name of your city and your name and your question. This will allow us to keep the discussion flowing and reduce repeat questions. If we can't get to your question during the call, you will be able to leave a voice message for the congressman at the end. A little extra incentive for you to join us for the entire hour. And finally, a recording of this telephone town hall will be available on our website in the coming days. So feel free to visit www.farr.house.gov and listen. Now I would like to introduce Congressman Sam Farr. He has served the Central Coast for more than 30 years as a county supervisor, state representative, and now your congressman. And again, if you have a question at any time, please press star 3 and a call screener will be ready for you shortly. And now joining us is Congressman Sam Farr. Congressman, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. I'm Sam Farr, and I'm excited to talk with all of you tonight. This is the first live telephone town hall meeting from Washington that I've ever had. A few of my colleagues have tried this and say it works very well, so I hope you'll be pleased with it, and we will have a nice, lively discussion. Of course, I'd rather be speaking to you in person, but we're still in session back here, and it seems like we're going to go all week and probably into next week, and we'd rather be home with our families in the holidays. But I'm glad you've joined in on this call, and I'd like to take a few minutes to let you know what we've been doing in Washington over the past few weeks, and after that, I'd be glad to take any questions on issues that you want to discuss. Congress has been busy, despite some of the reports that don't think so. We've worked with a new leadership and a new direction and spent more hours in Washington and more hours voting and more bills that have been passed out of the House than any time in recent history. We've worked very hard to end the war in Iraq and to stay out of Iran. We're helping to support our children in the United States through a better education system and certainly through health programs. For children, the S-CHIP is one that you've heard a lot about. We're making some progress on some other important issues, including the mortgage crisis, energy efficiency, and a new bill that we just passed out of the House last week, a new agricultural policy for the United States, and right now we're working on a bill to alleviate some of the burdens of the alternative minimum tax. You've also heard that Congress is running into some obstacles. We're having a tough time getting our appropriation bills passed. It's a pushback between the White House, who won't accept the rewrites of the bills that appropriate the money to run Congress, to run the United States government. We are emphasizing an awful lot of effort on vital programs to our children, to families, veterans, the environment, and so on. And the White House is blocking many of these bills, very much wanting to essentially emphasize the spending in Iraq and ask for more money while we're trying to emphasize the spending here at home. And that's kind of the big battle that's going on in Washington. That's a short review of what we've been doing, and I look forward to your questions because obviously that's what's first in your mind. So remember, if you want to ask a question, press star and 3 and then ask the question.
Thank you, Congressman. Now we're going to move on to our first question with Congressman Farr. If I may take the opportunity to open with a question that we've been hearing a lot about in the past few months, and that's the creation of a veteran cemetery on the Central Coast. Congressman, could you give us a little background on this issue and let us know what's new?
Well, the federal government's the one that builds veteran cemeteries, and we have two programs. Either the federal government can do it, and we have a federal veteran cemetery over in Santa Anella, over in the San Joaquin Valley. It's very far away for people from the Monterey Peninsula. But because it has so many opportunities of real estate for further burials, they don't want to open up and can't, under law, open up another cemetery which is within a 70-mile radius. So we have a plan B, which is to allow the state of California to operate it. This is done very often by states. Hawaii has 9 veteran cemeteries operated by the state of Hawaii. Governor Schwarzenegger, however, doesn't want to get into the operation of cemeteries, and so he has said he will not do that out of state maintenance money. The construction costs are all paid for by the federal government, but the ongoing maintenance costs are paid for by the state under Plan B. So we have come up with a very unique sort of Plan C, which is to get four of the Fort Ord Use Authority. They've just put up some money to do the feasibility study, which will then allow it to go out to bid so that we can raise some money among a private sector, because we have enough real estate out there to do some private development, maybe even a private cemetery alongside the veteran cemetery. So we think this is really going to be able to fly. It's just not the easiest way to go, but it will work, and I'm very excited about it because it's moving the way it should be moving right now.
Thank you very much, Congressman. One follow-up question that we've been hearing a lot about nationally, and I'm sure it's important to the district, is we've been hearing a lot of stories about the housing mortgage crisis. Can you give us some of your thoughts on the issue? And I just want to remind callers once again that *3 if you would like to ask a question of the congressman.
Well, the mortgage crisis is affecting millions of Americans. It's very serious, and the difficulty of how we got into this is the area that ended up kind of these what they called liar loans. They went out and approached people and said, you know, you really can get a 100% financed mortgage on your house. You don't have to put any down payment. You can pay interest only. What they didn't tell them was that these interest onlys were adjustable rate mortgages. And so what people are finding is that now that the rate has gone up, they can no longer afford it. And there's foreclosure. The foreclosure process obviously leaves a house that is not the value that was paid for. The foreclosure can evict the people that are in it, and then it has to resell at a shorted price. And I've heard that locally that a lot of realtors tell me that the lender will not allow those lower prices to pass for sale. And so we're in a dilemma, and Congress is essentially, we're working with the president to freeze the adjustable rate mortgage at a level. This will mostly affect people coming into this adjustment in January. It doesn't take care of the people who have already had a foreclosure notice. I'm going after the regulators and seeing if we can bring some pressure on it, because I understand that even people that are down in the trenches of trying to renegotiate their mortgage rate can't get a hold of the people that now hold the title to the mortgage, and it's just a sort of bureaucratic nightmare. So we're trying to attack it from all angles, and obviously it really affects the economy, because as your property values go down, you can get a lower tax rate, and then that means there's less revenue coming to the local schools and to cities and counties and so on. So the crisis isn't just for the person who is foreclosed, it's for the entire community, and we need to move in. Congress has moved in and changed the law so that this won't happen again, but for those that it's affected, it's a very, very, very serious problem, and I hope we can get to the bottom of it.
Thank you, Congressman. And we're going to take a call from Frank in Pebble Beach. Frank, you're on with Congressman Farr. Did you have a question regarding medical nutrition? Frank, are you there?
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm here.
Go ahead,
Frank. Can I hear your question?
Okay, sure. Just to re-identify what we're concerned with, I'm with the American Partnership for Eosinophilic Disorders, and we were so pleased and privileged to have Representative co-sponsor our legislation for a National Awareness Week coming up the third week in May. To that end, we would like to elicit and hopefully solicit the representative's support for House Resolution number 2805, which is the Medical Nutrition Therapy Act, currently sponsored by Javier Becerra of the Los Angeles area. I believe Zoe Lofgren is co-sponsoring our neighbor to the north, and we're actually hoping that Representative Farr would also consider co-sponsorship.
Well, I thank you very much for the ask, and I appreciate that. I've become aware of that bill just recently, and I think it's probably to your effort. And I am not yet a co-sponsor, but I certainly can sign on to that. And I know how important it is to you and your family, and I would be glad to co-sponsor it. To the people that are working on that issue who are on the Mr. Becerra is on the Ways and Means Committee, a close friend, and I will let him know tomorrow that we'd like to get involved with that. So I hope that will be helpful to you.
Thank you for your question, Frank, and I just want to remind the callers once more, it's *3 if you'd like to ask a question of the congressman. Next, we're going to go to Richard in Carmel. Richard, you're on the phone with Congressman Farr.
Thank you for taking my question, Congressman.
Hi, Richard.
Hi. Two things. One is that we sold our house up in the Santa Clara Valley last year and was somewhat shocked to find that the tax rules had changed about 5 years ago, and we could no longer shelter all of our capital gains by taking proceeds of the sale and moving it to another house here in Carmel, as it turns out. Now we get hits for capital gains, anything over $500,000. Now, if you're in some grotty southern state, that probably doesn't mean much, but in California, that really hurts. It's about $180,000 worth of tax I have to take. So I would like to see that revisited.
Richard, I really appreciate that issue. We have a lot of complexities in our tax law, but one of them, and in the administration even of the benefits under the tax law, is that you find that California often, because of the cost of everything in California, whether it's hospital bills or housing costs, just exceed the federal cap. And where $500,000 is an awful lot of money in some other states, and particularly rural America, it is not that much money in an expensive state like California. So when you do make these adjustments, they also cost the Treasury. And we have a policy here in Congress, and I think you'll appreciate that. It's called PAYGO, which means you don't pass laws unless you could pay for them. And that's the new speaker's policy, and it's actually written into the rules that we operate under. So whatever tax relief we get to increase it, we also have to find some ability to either cut or raise another revenue to pay for it. And that's usually was the stumbling block. But I'll check into this and see if we're making any progress on it. It does affect California real estate quite dramatically.
Thank you, Congressman. Next, we're going to take Bob from Carmel Valley. Bob from Carmel Valley, you had a question for the Congressman Farr.
Yes, I do. Thank you for taking my call, Congressman. I joined this conference a little late, so I'm not sure whether this question has been asked or not. But I was just wondering what steps Congress is taking to ensure that George Bush does not take us to war in Iran. When Bill Clinton was in office, he was impeached. Nancy Pelosi, I thought, was going to be working towards impeaching George Bush. And what I'm hearing is that they don't have the votes to do the impeachment. But effectively, what the Republican impeachment of Bill Clinton did was kept him so busy defending himself that he couldn't do his job. He couldn't continue growing our budget and our surplus. And I'm just wondering if there's any tactics that the Congress can use to slow Mr. Bush down from taking us yet into another misguided war.
We have several questions there, Bob, and I appreciate them. One, and the first one is, what are we doing to try to make sure that the administration doesn't lead us into a war in Iran, as they've led us into a war in Iraq? And I don't know if you had seen it, but I led a group of members of Congress in a press conference about 2 weeks ago on laying out all of the actions that are being taken in Congress to essentially challenge the executive branch that they can't go forward without authority from Congress. And what we learned last week was that the National Intelligence Review estimate is pointed out that Iran had stopped building nuclear weapons or just halted the practice several years ago. So it certainly would argue that we don't need to invade Iran. I think you find 70% of the Americans are concerned about this. What we are doing is probing the funds that are in Iraq and being used if that might be subverted to aggression in Iran. I think that our best, frankly, the briefings that I've gotten, and I'm really pleased to see that the military is the one that's having a big, strong note of caution here. I'm not advising that we ought to be on the brink of war with Iran. Congress is getting more and more engaged, and hopefully with his pieces of legislation that we'll be able to get these passed. The last part of your question was about impeachment, and I think you have to remember that a year from now we will have, and we will know who the new president of the United States, the next president, will be. You mentioned the Bill Clinton impeachment process. That took 13 months, and we don't have 13 months left, and that's where you had a special prosecutor that spent millions of dollars to lead up to making the articles of impeachment before the House Judiciary Committee, which was committed to doing it. The votes were there in the House and obviously never there in the Senate. I don't think the votes are either in the House or the Senate right now. By the way, I have co-sponsored all these pieces of legislation. So my feelings about it, I think, are the same as yours. And I think you'd be pleased to know that whenever these discussions take place, I'm out there talking about them. I just find that without the leadership feeling the ability to deliver on it, that they're not going to engage in it because we want to get all these other domestic issues and certainly get us out of Iraq rather than going into Iran and rather than just spending all our time on impeachment.
Okay, callers, we're probably going to be running the gamut for issues, so I want to again thank Congressman Farr and remind callers to if they would like to ask a question of Congressman Farr, to hit *3, and one of our call associates will be able to get to your call. Next, we have a question from Alfreda in Marina, and this is a question that's come up a lot. She had a question on immigration. Alfreda, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
I didn't have a lot of hope for comprehensive immigration reform, but I know that there are some small steps that have been proposed, and I'm wanting you to weigh in on what you, if you have hope that we might get some of those across, like the Save Our Small Seasonal Business Act, trying to get the H-2B visa extension for people who are returning workers, then the Ag Jobs Bill for particularly California depends on it. I heard today that the Hispanic caucus was holding up these small steps in order to force a larger immigration reform, and I just don't know where you are on this. What do you think we can actually expect to get done?
Well, Frieda, I'm pleased that you asked about it, and I'm also pleased that you're knowing about the various forms of legislation, pieces of legislation are going through. The one that's probably most popular is the Ag Jobs Bill. We cannot find a vehicle that is going to the president that there's a willingness to attach it to. So standing alone, it wouldn't get enough support in the House to pass it. But as a part of a bigger package, it would. That essentially deals with the farm workers in California, and we are the state that produces the specialty crops. We're the state that really needs these workers more than any other state, and we really don't have any replacement labor. What I'm hoping, and I talked to Howard Berman about it, who's leading the effort on the floor. Howard tonight and I we were voting earlier. We're talking about the extension of the H-2B, and what we might be able to do to come up with just the simplest of compromises, essentially a kind of a pass, or essentially a ability to say that if you've been here working, paying your taxes, and you can stay here. It doesn't give you any advantages to anything at this moment, because we can't get the votes to do comprehensive immigration reform. And I think even with the Hispanic caucus, and you can see their interest in trying to have comprehensive reform, it's what the president wants, and it's certainly we had the ability at one time to have the majority in the Senate want that, but that's melted. And so what we're trying to do is just the bare minimum to not create total chaos, which is what, as if you're dealing with business groups or farming groups, you're finding out is what's going to happen if we don't do anything. I do think, I'm optimistic that we can, because the president wants it, the leadership of the House and the Senate want it. It's just getting the votes on something that will work. And I think we're working at it every day that we will achieve something. I don't know when, but I'm optimistic.
Thank you for the question, Alfreda. Next, we have Bernice from Monterey. She had a question about global warming. Bernice, you're on the phone with Congressman Farr. And again, callers at *3.
Congressman Farr, good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm very concerned about the results of global warming, particularly the predicted rise of the oceans up to 4 feet, according to the UN panel, within the next 20 years. And I can just foresee what this would do to all the major cities in the world that are at ocean level now, such as New York, Paris, Los Angeles. And I'm just wondering, what is our government doing to combat this threat that is fast approaching?
Well, thank you very much for asking that question. And it's one dear to my heart. As you know, I've been very active in the alternative energy ever since I was a county supervisor and state legislator, and certainly back here on an awful lot of bills. We made some progress last week by passing a major energy reform bill that raises the CAFE standards, the standards that automobile industry has to meet. They're not as high as the standards that California has placed on the industry. And I think the good news, at least politically in this country, is that California, being such a big state and having such a large market and disposable income to buy things, is leading through their laws in the state and a bipartisan leadership in Sacramento to essentially create an awareness like we did on the Monterey Peninsula through water conservation about what is this carbon footprint that we're all responsible, each individual, each home, each building produces, and how can we reduce that. Counties, Santa Cruz County, I don't know if Monterey's gone there yet, have already hired somebody to look through all their building codes and the practices of what they're buying and they're purchasing and whether these add or subtract to the carbon footprint. And the point is that yes, if we know nothing about global warming and the ice caps continue to melt, we are the globe is headed for the biggest disaster in history, because we would have literally hundreds of millions of people that would be flooded out and would be underwater. And productive agricultural land and businesses, these people would have to migrate places. We're having enough over just immigration in California, the United States alone, and we haven't had to work with displaced of hundreds of millions of people in a country like Bangladesh. I know, because I've had even our intelligence agencies brief me on these environmental issues. They're very much aware of it, and I think what we're lacking is enough leadership in the presidential level to really make the world believe that America is committed to resolving. We are the biggest producer of this carbon footprint. And as you know, the new Prime Minister of Australia, Prime Minister Rudd, got elected on that issue, and immediately ratified Australia's joining the Kyoto Protocol. So the Kyoto Treaty. And I think that I think we're getting there. At the national level, we're not fast enough, but the sum total of our parts are moving faster than the federal government, and I think we have to just weigh in and do what we can locally and do it in our own homes. I mean, this changing of these light bulbs, I just found when you did that, an electric bill really substantially dropped. There's something that everyone can do.
Thank you, Congressman. And as a follow-up, I'm not sure if our audience is aware that you yourself have been quite the advocate for our national ocean policy. I was wondering if you could maybe touch on that issue as it relates to global warming.
Well, of all policies we have no policy in this country that looks at the impacts that were the negative impacts on the oceans. We kind of look at it from a fishing standpoint or a mining standpoint using electronic measurements and what the Navy's been using and things like that. But the sum total of all of these and other effects of how much pollution is being put in the ocean by just all the shipping, dumping, and you get the cumulative effects, which have been studied by several commissions, one created by Congress and the other created by the Pew Charitable Trust. Leon Panetta was chair of the Pew Charitable Trust. They made wonderful recommendations to the American people, which we picked up in my bill, plus the commission that I helped create that President Bush appointed. had made some terrific recommendations, and that all of those have been put into a House bill called Oceans 21, H.R. 21, and I'm the author of that bill, and it's co-sponsored by Republicans and Democrats. We're moving it through the process. We're in the Interior Committee, the Natural Resources Committee. We do have a tough time getting some votes from people because the special interest groups don't want change, and that's normal. But I think by the this time next year, we ought to be able to have that bill well on its way.
Great. Terrific. Callers, again, that's star 3 if you'd like to ask a question of Congressman Farr. We are getting quite the intake of calls, so please have some patience if you're trying to get through and have your question asked to the congressman. I want to bring up a call from Donna Brilly from Monterey. She had a question regarding some of the indictment issues that have come up this year. Donna, are you on the phone?
Yes, hi. Congressman, first of all, I want to applaud you for representing us so brilliantly and supporting so many of us that are feeling frustrated with the leadership, with Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein, and at least you're someone that's speaking for us. And I'm really, really grateful to you, and I want you to know that. And
thank
following
you
on that, do you foresee that there'll be any time when Karl Rove, Harriet Myers, any of these people are going to be indicted or held accountable? I mean, of course we want, to follow up with Cheney and Bush and all of them, but these people that seem to be getting away with more and more, and, you know, the CIA and destroying the tapes, there's just so much, and I just want to know if that's proceeding in many ways that you know of, where these people are going to be held accountable for the actions they've taken.
Well, the indictment process is triggered by a grand jury, a federal grand jury, which is obviously established through the Department of Justice, which has the Attorney General is appointed by the President of the United States. So in answer to getting a federal indictment, I don't see this administration initiating that. However, the House Judiciary Committee has been staffing this pretty well of collecting all this information, and I understand that if actions have been done that are indictable, that are illegal and against the law, those actions can be brought against individuals long after they've left their office. So in answer to your question, yes, if the material's there and there's an interest in proceeding, and a lot of it will depend on who the next president is, but the House itself, through oversight committees, can do this. Right now, what we're trying to do is we have so much work just on the FISA bill and on the Homeland Security and the Patriot Act and things like that that are coming up for renewal, fighting those that we have, and we, as I heard to an earlier caller, there's just not votes in the House to begin sort of the impeachment indictment process, much less any support coming out of the administration for it. So I think what we will see is that there may be some votes on contentment of Congress against Ms. Myers and Mr. Bolton.
Congressman, we had a follow-up question to the caller that was calling about H.R. 2805, and I just want to put them on the line right now. Caller, you were calling in about H.R. 2805, a follow-up question?
Yeah, thank you so much. Due to the miracles of cell technology, I think I was cut off during the earlier conversation, so I certainly was unable to, first of all, hear Representative Farr's response, and I did have a short follow-up. Also as a sort of a awareness to our public of what has occurred since May with this disease.
And again, well, caller, that was in regards to the H.R. 2805, correct?
Right.
That's a medical nutrition bill, what I heard, and I don't know whether you heard on from that. I will be becoming a co-sponsor of that bill.
Great.
I know you've been in touch with our office, and we know how much it affects your family, and we are very very supportive of your and try to help as much as possible to bring attention to that to the medical issues here.
Sure.
Caller, are you there? Sounds like we might have lost his cell phone again. Congressman, for the next issue, we had Fatima from Monterey calling about a student loans, and maybe you could touch on that. Fatima, are you there? You were calling about student loan repayments?
Yes, Congressman, thank you for taking my call. I teach at DLI and I'm with the Department of Defense.
What language do you teach, Fatima?
I teach Persian Farsi.
Oh, well, thank you for your service.
Yes, thank you. It's my pleasure. It's something that I enjoy very much, especially at the time that we are in a war and our soldiers definitely need the language. I am concerned about my student loan, and I'm referring to the College Cost Reduction Act of 2007 for public service loan forgiveness. It requires that I have to be teaching or be a full-time teacher for 10 years. And before I am able to take advantage of this forgiveness, I have about $100,000 of loan, which was $60,000, and $40,000 is interest that has been accumulated. I'm also a cancer patient, which I have a high medical bill, and living in California, it's not easy. So I was wondering if there is any other provision that can help me for this repayment plan other than what is available.
Fatima, thank you for asking the question, and as I said, thank you for teaching Farsi. We certainly are appreciative of your work in this country and at the DLI. Let me answer this in two ways. First of all, we are trying to bring a lot of incentives to forgive student loans or reduce them by, well, one, we've acted new legislation that will allow that, but to forgive it is, it, like you talked about, being in service in certain categories. And I didn't know whether the DLI qualified, but you know what I think we should do with you, because you have two issues. One is the cost of the student loan and the interest that's accumulated there, plus now the new cost treating your cancer. If you could call my office in Salinas, which is 424-2229, 424-2229, my office in Salinas will work on a casework for you and be able to appeal certain issues to the federal government. And we don't just make laws in Washington. We also take care of individuals' problems, and hopefully we can pursue that for you. And I want to do that.
Terrific. And Congressman, again, DLI, that was the Defense Language Institute, which I believe is located within your district, correct?
In Monterey, it's a great school.
In regards to student loan repayments, she brought up an important question that has been the focus of some education policy this year. Did you want to kind of follow up on what has happened with that?
Well, education is being a very high priority. It's such a high priority because if you look at our national security policy, that the strongest and most the best way to invest in a national security is to a well-educated populace. So education is our first line of defense against ignorance and poverty, and which creates violence and all kinds of, and leads people to war. So yes, Congress is paying a lot of attention to this, and we have created, we have the law that we're working on to rewrite, almost totally rewrite the No Child Left Behind. We have worked on and passed College Cost Reduction Act. It became law in September. That costs the taxpayer nothing. It pays for itself by cutting the excess subsidies that were paid to the loan industry, and it reduces the interest rates on a need basis, and increases the grants to students out there, Pell Grants. These are grants. These aren't loans. These are money that's given to students to $5,200 by the year 2012. And it also provides a special assistance to people that are going into public careers, as I was talking about with Fatima.
Excellent. That brings us, I think, to another issue that we've heard a lot about. And Tom from Pacific Grove had a question regarding No Child Left Behind that you touched on briefly, Congressman. Tom, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And you had a question for the Congressman.
Congressman Farr, I am a high school teacher in Pacific Grove, and we watch our students progress through the No Child Left Behind situation of recent years, and we've seen some improvement. However, we still do not graduate students who are prepared for the workplace and prepared to be able to continue our innovation. Can you tell me, what are you doing on that interface?
Tom, is this because I'm not prepared for the workplace because there's no emphasis on the sort of the vocational efforts, or do you mean it's that our curriculum and the curriculum of California public schools is not substantive enough to prepare for people for the workplace? I'm not sure what you're... Sorry, I know there's a big emphasis on you know, the reading, writing, arithmetic in No Child Left Behind, which has cost school districts the ability to also provide alternative services in music and vocational training as well. And so I wondered if that's what you were mentioning.
Well, it's the preparation both of the high school graduate who goes directly into the workplace, but also mm-hmm. those who go to college, because in California colleges, more than half of the graduates who go to the UCs are having to take remedial math and English.
Well, you as a high school teacher will know, and thank you for doing that. Thank you for being a teacher. I think it's one of the greatest professions possible, because it's, you know, anybody who's ever been successful or in any field has always looked back and said what made the biggest difference in their lives were a teacher, along with their family or friends. So I'm always thinking the teachers are on one of the highest pedestals you can put people on. And I've been very involved in education. When I sat in the state legislature, I was on the education committee for 12 years, and both higher and lower ed. And you have this sort of battle back and forth of higher ed saying that the K-12 system isn't doing enough to prepare people for college because they have to give so many remedial courses. That isn't necessarily new. And when I was going to college, there were a lot of remedial courses for people in English, particularly at Berkeley and other schools and other university campuses. I do think you've got a lot of issues here. Remember, those students got into those colleges because they were smart. I mean, they're not, as you know, it's a much harder to get in. There's fewer places available than there are students that want to go, even to all of our higher ed systems. So No Child Left Behind is essentially a national policy. We don't have a national education system in America. There's no national requirement for education. There's no national teaching credential. There's no national testing. It's left up to the states. That's the way people want to keep it. The Clinton administration, the Bush administration, both moved to try to get some national assessment standardized across the country, and there was a pushback. So we have 50 different ways of testing students by 50 different states, and that's the trouble with No Child Left Behind. I think California is, frankly, one of the better at on higher standards than almost any other state, and that's why we're also having such a fail rate, because we hold the bar pretty high. And what we're trying to do is make sure, as you know, as a teacher, and I know as a parent, it's not just the grade that students get. It's a whole community of effort. You know, we used to grade students on good behavior and attendance, and at least that built some self-esteem in students. And I think that you got to look at everything, and essentially the community value. Pacific Grove values its public education system. It passed all the bond issues that were necessary. It's got a very good reputation. It used to have, you know, incredible music system. I don't know what's happened to that with No Child Left Behind, but I'm trying to make sure that this bill doesn't just penalize people and drive the very kids that we need to get an education out of school, so that they drop out, they get discouraged, teachers get discouraged, and we lose the talent on both ends, in the schools that may blossom later on in life, and in the teaching faculty in itself, which I find an awful lot of people are throwing up their hands and just saying, I'm moving out of the profession. And I think that if Congress is enacting bills to do that, it's wrong.
Thank you, Congressman. And one more time, I want to remind our callers that if you'd like to ask a question to Congressman Farr, just press *3, and someone should be with you shortly. Again, there is a lot of callers on the line, but we're working as fast as we can to get to your calls. Congressman, we'd like to move to another issue, the FISA issue, which is Barbara from Carmel Valley. Barbara from Carmel Valley, you had a question regarding the FISA and telephone companies.
Yes, can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Go ahead, Barbara.
Oh, good. Hi, thank you. Hi, Congressman Farr. First, I want to thank you for your courage on so many issues. I have a question about the issue of retroactive immunity for the telecom carriers who enabled President Bush and Vice President Cheney to violate the FISA Act. And my my most important point, and I would encourage you to be our champion in Congress and carry this message to all of your Democratic colleagues in both houses, and that is that the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, states explicitly, and I quote, "Congress shall pass no ex post facto law." Look up ex post facto in the dictionary. It means retroactive law. It would be blatantly unconstitutional to do this, and I would request that you would be our champion carrying that message to every Democratic member and every reasonable Republican member of both houses of Congress.
Well, thank you very much for calling and asking this question, and for other listeners that are on the line, if we don't get to your question at the end, you're going to be able to leave it via voicemail, and we will respond to every single one of them. The FISA issue has been extremely controversial. I've been opposed to the way they've been trying to reform it in the takeaways. It used to work very well, and the administration complained it hampered them. They couldn't find cases that justified their point, but still went ahead and used the fear tactic and got a bill passed. It's I opposed it. I opposed it in the original form and in the last form that passed the House. We have a mixed bag of feeling about it here in Congress, even from California. Our senators are split. I think Dianne Feinstein supports it and Barbara Boxer opposes it. But I think you share everybody's concern. They just don't want the government snooping into their records, into their telephone conversations or into their telephone records or into their checking books out from the library, what they're reading or any of those things. I just think that has no place in our society, in a modern democracy, to have the federal government being one that we're afraid of. And I think that these FISA bills, if not handled properly, can become that. You know, the regulations require that if the administration, the president has, wants to do wiretapping, they have to go to an independent magistrate, to a judge. They have to lay out all the evidence of why this should be wiretapped. And the judges decide. And from discussions here, an awful lot of them are turned down because they just don't have the merit. And that is a check and balance that's worked well for this country for a long time. And to erode that balance, I think, would be very dangerous for our country.
Thank you, Congressman. And to tie into another issue that's been brought up a couple times, which affects immigration and education, is the Federal Dream Act. And we wanted to take a call from Victor Torres in Marina. Victor, are you on the phone?
How's it going, Congressman?
Hi, Victor. Thanks for calling.
Victor, maybe you could quickly describe what the Dream Act is for us and in your position on it.
Well, I work for Cal State Monterey Bay. I'm an admissions evaluator currently, but I used to run admissions for the Education Opportunity Program. And so with that, one of my responsibilities was working with the Monterey County Office of Education, specifically with the Migrant Ed Department. And Manuel Bepsamin, who was the mayor of Watsonville, he came in and he was letting us know about the DREAM Act, and he was also letting us know how you were a firm supporter of it. And that you were a fighter for us. And so I'm honored to be on the phone with you tonight. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you, Victor. First of all, let me explain what it is. The DREAM Act would allow students who qualify for college get accepted, but who are low income be able to get student financial aid. Right now, if you are not, if you don't have a green card, and a lot of these young people were brought across the border when they were very young, many of them don't even know that they weren't born in this country until they reach. I mean, and it's very interesting, Victor. The whole issue of identity in this country is that the United States has no national ID system. In fact, Homeland Security tells me there are 8,000. Recognized official identifications in this country. And so when you're a child, the first time you're really asked to sort of get an idea is when you would go to get a driver's license, which are issued by the states, in this case, California. And as you know, California will not issue a driver's license without a birth certificate or a green card. And so what happens is these students don't get a chance to get into college. Now, they're the brightest students in school. And so where I've really been moved by this is the number of teachers, classroom teachers, of principals of schools, of colleges actually saying this kid has been accepted to our school, and he's one of the brightest she's one of the brightest we've ever had, and we really want him in there. They could get a private scholarship, a foundation scholarship, but not a public scholarship. So the DREAM Act is to essentially make sure that we don't force the best and brightest people that could be in our university systems and college systems, like California State University, from not being able to afford to go to school because of their childhood immigration status. And it's got a lot of support in Congress. Again, we might be able to get this thing passed before the elections of next year.
Okay, Congressman, we have Rosalie from Monterey. Rosalie, you're on the phone with Congressman Farr. You had a question regarding kids in trouble.
Yeah. Hey, Senator Farr, it's been a long time since I've seen you. Hope your wife and daughter are doing well.
Thank you very much. They are.
Good. I teach for the Monterey County Office of Education, and I teach in South County. I drive from Monterey to Soledad and to Gonzales, every day. The kids down there have all been expelled. They're on probation. There is nothing in South County, a Boys and Girls Club. There's no gang prevention programs. They don't even have, I think there's one small office of Planned Parenthood in Greenfield, and that's it. There's no provisions for these kids at all.
Well, Greenfield has a very good program for high school dropouts. Home Build, I'm having a blank on exactly the name of the foundation that's created, but what they do is Greenfield is one of the few cities in the county that does this. I've been very, very impressed with it. They take these kids who've dropped out or have been in trouble. They give them schooling. At the same time, they're rebuilding housing in the area, and then when they're finished, the housing is brought up to code and is remodeled, and it's given to a low-income person, and they work with contractors on it. They're learning a skill that employs them. At the same time, they're getting an education. So there are some programs out there. Obviously, it's not enough to reach out to every child. We are spending a lot of effort looking at the whole violence through gang efforts in our area. Salinas obviously is the one that gets all the attention, but that permeates in every community. And it's interesting because you as a teacher would know that you can't just do this just by police suppression alone. It really takes rehabilitation. It takes prevention, which Salinas is doing through money that we've been able to get from the federal government to work with all the law enforcement and social agencies in Monterey County. Sort of the ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I mean, I'd like to engage with you and the mayors of South County as to what we can do to improve these outreach programs for after-school services and things like that, plus the foundations that are trying to reach out to kids that are sort of dropping through the cracks. We certainly have some programs to pay attention to that. Thank you for your call.
Thank you, Congressman. I'll remind everyone that if we don't have a chance to get your call here tonight, you can stay on the line and leave a message for the congressman. And if you do wish to ask a question, I remind you to chime in at *3. Next, Congressman, we're going to take a question from Kalila in Seaside. Kalila, are you there? You had a question for Congressman Farr? Hello? Kalila?
Yes, this is Kalila, and I am very happy to talk to the congressman. I've spoken with him before, and I'm very happy at the job that he's doing.
Thank you.
My question is, I am a retired nurse, and as being so, I'm very interested in the universal health care for people, and I was wondering what your position is on the subject of health care.
Kalila, thank you for being a nurse. Certainly. certainly I've had enough accidents in my life where I've spent a lot of time in hospitals.
And so have I.
I really appreciate the service that you and everybody gives to the caring field.
Thank you.
Yeah, we need an. I don't know if you've seen this movie Sicko, but it's you know, it is a, or say it's a propaganda film, but it's certainly a very educational film, and it I think it makes one, anyone in the United States, after seeing that, realize that it's not only the uninsured people that need access to education. The insurance companies are denying people who have insurance from having their claims, or even from qualifying for care. And it's a real crisis in this country. We have not any leadership out of the White House to have a universal health care plan in the United States. I think it's coming. In the first Clinton administration, the First Lady Hillary Clinton tried to make this a national policy, got really pushed around, got it pushed around by a lot of the medical community. Now that they've seen what's happened, a lot of those medical providers now on the side of providing universal health care. We do have a program in the United States that is very good. It's called Medicare. One has to be 65 to get access to it. But whether you're rich or poor, you get equal treatment and equal payment. And if we could afford to do that for all the nation, we would have a single-payer plan. Medicare is a single-payer plan. But we couldn't afford to do it as long as the cost of health care stays where it is. So it's two reforms. It's one, getting everybody in the tent. And we have about 40 million Americans that still don't have any insurance. And we're trying to reach out to children first, because they're the most vulnerable, and cover all of them. This is what is called the SCHEP bill that we passed, and it got vetoed, and we're still working on it and try to get a second version to the president. And then a ways of bringing down the cost, and that is going to be a struggle. And as you know, health care in this country is extremely expensive, way too expensive for anybody to afford, even for insurance companies, as the costs are just skyrocketing. So those are the two reforms. I don't think we're going to get it done in this next year, but I do believe that this is the number one issue going into the presidential elections, and I think that a candidate can't get elected president of the United States unless they were willing to tackle this issue.
Thank you, Congressman. And we're just about out of time, but I want to remind everyone that if you haven't gotten to your question yet, that everyone on the call, especially those that have questions that we haven't had time to address, you will have a chance to leave a voicemail for the Congressman at the end of the call, and I would encourage you to do so. For those of you wishing to do that or chime in, it's *3. Congressman, we've got a number of inquiries from the audience tonight regarding something that's been in the news for all too long for some of us, and that's the situation in Iraq. I wonder if you could maybe give us an update about Iraq and what's going on in Congress.
Well, the battle in Iraq is essentially just, it's kind of a black and white battle. The leadership in the House and the Senate, and they're in the majority, the Democrats, have been trying to bring the troops home, and we've been doing that by conditioning the money that would go to the Department of Defense for continuing the war, that money can only be spent to turn the troops around to bring them home. It's physically impossible to bring them all home the same day, so it's going to take some time, and obviously there's different exit strategies that all of the Democratic candidates for president, I've heard them in debates talk about them. They're not all the same, but some are stronger than others. But I can tell you that Congress is two, three times have voted this year to only use the money in Iraq as long as the troops can come home, and that would be home a year from now. Those bills get vetoed by the president, and when we try to override them, we don't have enough votes. We can get some Republican votes passing the bill, but those same Republicans won't vote to override their president. So we're kind of stuck. In fact, that's why we're here this week. We should have been home a couple of weeks ago. Usually Congress adjourns about Thanksgiving, and we're here basically because of the Iraq funding. And I can tell you that we're ready to stay and fight this one out. So the Senate has a different viewpoint than the House, but it is the issue, and I'm glad you asked about it.
Again, I want to thank Congressman Farr for taking the time to try this new version of a town hall, a telephone town hall, and we hope the audience did enjoy it as well. Congressman, if you wanted to take a couple minutes to kind of wrap up, and I want to remind the callers that, again, if we didn't have a chance to get to your question, that you can leave a message at the end that you will get a response to. Again, that's *3 to ask a question. And, Congressman, if you wanted to give a few closing words.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate everybody. You know, I can't imagine getting these calls. You just want to sort of hang up. But I really appreciate it because I think this technology is a very effective way of being able to communicate. I'm here in Washington, D.C. I'd love to have town hall meetings in every community, and I do when I'm back in the district. But, again, it's time-consuming, and you have to go, and sometimes the leisure of using your own phone. If you like this, I'd really like to hear about it. And if you don't like it, let me know, too. We can actually remove your telephone so they wouldn't be called if we do this in the future. I'd like to see if you think we ought to continue to do it. I'm sorry we didn't have enough time to answer every question, but in a few moments we got an awful lot of broad range of questions, and as was just said, that you can leave a voicemail message. And obviously, I'm always responsive to your calls and needs and letters, emails, or written letters throughout the year, and my office in Salinas is all doors are always open for you. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to wish you all a very pleasant good night.